The team at the Investigators and Burning Mountain Productions would like to remind you that persons associated with crimes or potential wrongdoing discussed on this episode are presumed innocent until proven otherwise in a court of law or administrative action.
Oh, I've been running from the law. Hope they won't shoot me down soon.
I'm Todd McComas.
And I'm Jessica Knoll. And we are
the Investigators.
Try to catch me howling at the moon.
Welcome back, 1041ers, and welcome all new listeners who don't know what the hell that means. We hope you had a crime-free week. And if you did not, we hope that everyone is okay and that you have the right investigators on the case. I'm sure you've noticed by now, this podcast is not the podcast it used to be. Well, it's been well over a year since we last spoke, and that's because of other ventures, projects, and agreements I had entered into. And even though they caused me a long hiatus, it was all worth it, because now we're back, bigger and better, as the Investigators, meaning we investigate now. And yes, I said we, because during my hiatus, I was partnered with one of the most talented investigators and podcast producers I've ever had the privilege to work aside. And after a little convincing, she has graciously agreed to produce and host this new version of the show with me. She's an award-winning investigative journalist. She's produced numerous hit podcasts over the years, like Bardstown and The Officer's Wife. But most recently, she's produced Dateline's Missing in America series, ever heard of that? Culpable Season 2, and she was the producer and voice of Undetermined. Please welcome my partner in crime, Jessica Knoll.
That was an incredibly ridiculous, warm welcome, but I appreciate it. I am so honored to be here and to tell these stories alongside you. Plus, I'm eager to dive into these cases with our listeners every week. And to piggyback off your opening to our listeners, if you don't have the right investigators on your case, reach out to us. That's what we're here for, to give a voice to the voiceless, dig for answers, and shine a light on your story.
Most of these cases that we're going to be covering come from Jessica's world. Jessica is revered within this industry, and a lot of people reach out to her asking her to help share with you the stories that they're trying to get out there. So that is another reason I'm excited that this partnership is going. And I want to apologize right now if my voice is gruffer than even usual. I think I'm the only person in the world to ever go from Indiana to Los Angeles and come back with a head cold. Like, I don't know what it was. It was cold and rainy the whole time, Jessica. I hear all these stories. It's my first trip to LA. Oh, you used to live there, right?
Yeah. Well, you know what's funny is when you went there, I checked the weather in LA because I'm like, oh man, he's going to be bragging about sunny and 60 or 70 degrees. And I look and it's the same weather that we have here in the Midwest. So, you know, I got a few giggles out of that. But yes, I did live in LA for a short period of time. And I'm sorry, you got the raw end of the deal with that trip because it's normally just gorgeous there.
So. I really enjoyed it. You know, I got some work done, but also, like, I'm a big fan of street food. And I stayed with my buddy, Nick, while we were there. And I was able to walk to two different amazing taco trucks.
That is the staple. If anyone goes to LA, I always recommend find a taco truck, and especially find a taco truck that's got a little old lady working in it because she knows her shit. And I have never had better tacos than on the dirty streets of LA. No offense to LA, but the dirty streets of LA, where there was a woman probably in her 70s, maybe 80s, who handed me these tacos, and it was heaven on a tray. And cheap. And the cheapest thing you can probably find in Los Angeles. Delicious. And you'll never, no matter where you go, if they say street tacos, do not trust them unless they're on a taco truck in the streets of LA coming out the window from a little old lady.
That was my favorite one. You described it perfectly. Just a crappy old van with a tarp over, you know, to keep the misty rain off her and the food that she was cooking. And I don't know, she's like 70 something. Mm-hmm. And she's just there by herself, like no security, nothing. And, you know, you said dirty streets. You're right. There's a lot of trash. Sometimes the occasional poop. But it's part of the charm. And amazing tacos, more than we could eat for $15. Four giant tacos. You could only eat like 2.5. And I can eat a lot of food and a drink. Like, you couldn't beat it. So
it's the beauty behind the grit. And one other thing is my husband, where he worked every week, this, again, woman, an older Mexican woman, would drive up her car, pop her trunk, and sell homemade tamales out of her trunk. And he bought them every time and brought them home. The best food.
Hands down, it's the single most positive thing about my experience there. And there were a lot of positives, but it's good enough that I would move there. And I've said this my entire life, especially as it's involved show business. I would never move to LA. I would never move to LA. Well, yes, I would.
Todd's mind.
Just for the tacos, I would move there. Okay, enough about my addiction to street tacos. We are here to dig into cases, and we are both especially eager to dive into this particular one. So let's read the listeners into it. On Sunday, March 7th, 1993, a man in East Providence, Rhode Island, goes to his girlfriend's third-floor apartment. The door is ajar, and as he steps inside, he sees clumps of hair everywhere. He hasn't seen or heard from his 30-year-old girlfriend for 6 days. In fact, no one has been able to reach her. Fearing what he might find if he searches further, he leaves her apartment and goes to the police station to request a wellness check.
When police arrive at her home along with her boyfriend, it's immediately pretty evident that something isn't right. As they enter the living room, there are clumps of dark hair all over, as well as a clump of light brown hair on a gym shoe and baby sock sitting on a table. The officer yells out, but no one answers. Then they hear water running. As they follow the sound of running water, they reach the bathroom doorway, where they find the man's girlfriend lying on the bathroom floor. She's naked, and she's not breathing. And there's more hair between her toes and strands of her own dark brown hair twisted through her fingers and wrapped around her wrist. She has fresh bruises on her arm and her upper thighs, and there are slices of bread strewn around her body.
As officers continue to search the apartment, they discover a couple things that immediately raise questions. First, the refrigerator is stocked full of food, but it's unplugged from the wall. It wouldn't make sense that the homeowner would do this because the food would go bad. So if not her, then who? And why?
They also discover two drinking glasses on the kitchen table, along with a plastic tub filled with a salad. Was she having dinner with someone? Drinks? And if so, again, who? And how did this woman end up naked and dead on the bathroom floor?
We're going to dive into all of this. But first, let's go back a year and a half before this shocking discovery was made. Let's go back to what was no doubt her happiest day. The day she became a new mother. In 1991, she gave birth to a beautiful, healthy little girl whom she named Lauren Lee. Tragically, Lauren was only 18 months old when her mother was found dead.
Now, that little girl is all grown up and investigating her mother's death, trying to figure out what happened to her and why a lifetime of memories were stolen from her. And along the way, on her journey for the truth, she's been getting to know her mom, the woman known to those closest to her as Sled Dog. This is Lori Lee Sled Dog Malloy's story.
The one thing that stands out is she used to always sing to me, and everybody talks about it, and I can remember her doing that. And she was just, you know, for me, this really warm, light, happy person. And that's, you know, the feeling that remains all these years later. Part of researching my mom's case, I had to understand who she was as a person. She passed at age 30. So it was like, even though our lives were radically different and obviously totally different time periods, I was going through a lot of the same things that I'm sure she was. And like, I really related to who she was, not just as my mom or as another person, but as a fellow woman. And that was really unique to me. She grew up in East Providence, Rhode Island. She was a mostly straight A student in school, captain of her junior high cheerleading squad. I had a lot of friends. When she was a teenager, probably around 18 or 19, she kind of took off from East Providence and went on her first of many road trips with friends of hers who rode motorcycles and, you know, went here, there, everywhere. She spent some time in the Florida Everglades. Probably her biggest trip was when she was in her early 20s. She went all the way over to Alaska to go be with the love of her life. My mom actually earned her own nickname, Sled Dog, which people see everywhere. Where does it come from? She was really interested in dog sled racing when she was in Alaska. Somehow she got into it and learned how to do it from an Iditarod winner. So she had a lot of fun and loved dogs. This really started in August of 2020. Someone sent me, this woman, a random Facebook message and was like, "Hey, are you the daughter of Lori Lee Malloy?" She's from East Providence, Rhode Island. She said that she was one of my mom's really good friends, and she ended up sending me pictures of my mom. That really got my attention because, you know, one of the pictures was her with Harry Mariano on their wedding day. And one of the first things she said to me was, "Everything you know about your mom's death is a lie. She didn't die of heart disease. She was murdered."
Okay, you've been read into Lori's case and you've heard from her daughter, Lauren. Now it's time to join us in the war room so we can take a deeper dive into what we know about her mother's case.
And to understand what happened to Lori, we need to take a hard look at her last week and days, final moments alive. On either Thursday, February 25th or Friday, February 26th, Lori goes to the doctor for what she thinks might be the flu. Then on Friday, Lori has her mom bring her baby Lauren over to her sister's house so she can watch her while she recovers from not feeling well. Also during that last week of February, her boyfriend, Henry Costa, witnesses a man pull up to Lori's apartment, a man who he said is Lori's drug dealer.
I just want to point out something real quick. Her boyfriend, Henry Costa, tells investigators he saw Lori doing cocaine with this D guy that D brought with him because he's not just an owner, he's an operator, sometime during the week of February 21st through the 28th. Now, this isn't super important yet because people buy and do cocaine all the time without being murdered by their dealers, but let's stick this tidbit of information in our pocket for later.
Done. So Lori's sick at the end of February. And this is about 10 or so days before she's found dead inside her apartment, and about 5 days before no one sees or hears from her again. So that radio silence from her for the better part of a week sounds like a significant change in her normal pattern of life. Probably something we should jot down in our investigator's notebook, right?
I'm going to write it in mine. And mine has Captain America on the cover, in case anybody was wondering.
Mine has leopard print, but I digress. Because with her illness begins this period of isolation from the people in her inner circle. People who would otherwise be able to tell investigators where she was and what she was doing, but giving her baby to her family to watch while she's sick now gives her a reason to be alone, right? And a reason not to communicate with people in her life like she normally would.
Jesus, stepson of Joseph. I can feel this case getting tougher to investigate by the minute. We are losing witnesses left and right, and I need witnesses because I'm not a wizard. I'm just a detective. And yes, I realize I just used Jesus and wizard in the same paragraph, and that's going to cause some unwanted DMs. But Jessica, can you please save me a couple key witnesses?
You know, that's not how investigations or crimes work, because I'm about to take another witness from you. Monday, March 1st is the last time her sister, Allison, sees her alive. That's the day Lori brings Allison some extra clothes for Lauren's stay. And even though she's still not feeling well, Lori does go shopping with her mom while Allison watches Lauren. This also happens to be the last day Henry sees or hears from Lori. According to his statement to police, she had asked him to bring her some cigarettes. And then they ended up arguing on the front porch.
I'm getting a sneaky suspicion. I need to be concerned about this boyfriend. Go on.
Okay, so he told police they argued over her cocaine use. Lori told him to leave her alone and that she'd do what she wanted to do.
So it sounds like maybe we have increased cocaine use more than what's normal for her leading up to her feeling so sick. If Henry's telling the truth, that's a significant behavior change. So if we were investigating this back in 1993, we would make note of that and start searching for a reason for her increased cocaine use and hope that maybe that reason is related to what happened to her so we can help figure things out. See, this requires zero magic. It's all common sense.
Well, Todd, I think we have plenty of the second and none of the first, so we're good to go. Back to the timeline. So on Tuesday, March 2nd, her sister Allison calls her three times with no answer. And finally, around 5 o'clock, Lori answers the phone and tells her she's really tired and that she slept all day. She asks her sister if she'll swing by and pick her up the next day so she can cash her check and go back to the doctor.
Okay, so on March 2nd, she's making plans for the future. Not that anyone has alleged suicide in this case, but I just like to point out things the listener should get in the habit of writing in their notebook. Plans for the future, not consistent with suicide. Got it.
So then, either the same day her sister spoke to her, or the next day, she can't remember which, Lori calls her friend Rebecca Lascarbo. Rebecca tells police that Lori was slurring her words, giggling, and kind of groggy. She says Lori told her that she took pills that made her feel good, but Rebecca didn't know what they were. She also thought someone might have been there with Lori when they talked on the phone.
Okay, so her sister didn't describe her being in that condition when she spoke to her on the phone, but Lori did tell her that she had slept all day. So I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess her friend Rebecca spoke to her earlier in the day, maybe even in the morning of the same day her sister spoke with her, March 2nd. Because I'm thinking after they spoke, Lori crashed for several hours. And after she woke up, she spoke to her sister. And of course, she's more coherent by then because she slept off whatever drug she was describing to Rebecca. And because her sister couldn't reach her the following day, March 2nd is probably the last day anyone heard from her. And I'm going to base this guess mostly on that clever deductive reasoning I just did, but also on what I think you're probably going to tell us next.
Remember, Rebecca didn't remember which day, either March 2nd or March 3rd, that she spoke to her. So either it was the day that Lori also talked to her sister, or it's the next day, Wednesday, March 3rd, which was when her sister Allison was actually supposed to pick her up.
But probably Tuesday, March 2nd.
Okay. So that said, sometime between 9 and 10 a.m., Allison does, in fact, go to Lori's to take her to cash her check and to the doctor's like she had asked her to the day prior. But no one answers the door. And after leaving, she calls Lori day and night. No answer. About 7 o'clock, a worried Allison calls Henry, Lori's boyfriend, and asks if he has seen her or if he's spoken with her. But Henry hasn't seen or heard from her since Monday.
He's her boyfriend, by the way, and she hasn't been feeling good. Take her some soup, for Christ's sakes. Acts of service is one of the 5 love languages.
It's one of my major ones. You can ask my husband. But let's not forget, they got into an argument the last time they saw each other.
Okay, then take her some flowers or an assortment of fine chocolates. Receiving gifts is another one.
It's not one of mine, but I'm with you, Todd. On that note, let's go back a little bit to someone who we are absolutely sure cared about her well-being, Allison. She keeps calling her sister over the next few days, all the way through Saturday, but still no answer. Then comes Sunday, March 7th. Around 10 a.m., Henry calls Rebecca, her friend, concerned because no one has seen or heard from her.
Oh, ha! Hold the mother truck and boat right there. Lori's sister called him on March 3rd, all worried because no one had seen or heard from her. And he, her boyfriend, waits another 4 days after that to finally get worried enough to start making moves. Can you see my nose twitching? It's because something stinks.
I do. We'll see what happens here, because after he hangs up with Rebecca, Henry actually goes to Lori's himself, and he enters her apartment. He doesn't have a key, but it didn't matter because the door was left open. When he walks in, he immediately spots those clumps of hair scattered everywhere, and fearful of what he might find, he bolts. He leaves.
He doesn't look around the place? What if someone's holding her at knife point in the bedroom?
That's a very good question, Todd. The answer is nope. He did not stick around.
I mean, what the fuck? Is your nose twitching at all?
No, but my eyes are watering because I'm allergic to bullshit and dust mites.
All right, go on.
All right, so he leaves the apartment without looking around and goes to the East Providence police station to request a wellness check. By this time, according to the police report, it's about 1 o'clock. This is 3 hours later when Henry and Officer Antonio Brito walk through the front door together, which, by the way, is still open, and walk into the living room. And the officer yells out, "Hello!" No answer. But they can hear water running. So the officer and Henry follow the sound of the running water. And when they get to the bathroom, it's when they find Lori. She's naked on the floor. Her body is inside the bathroom with her head just outside the bathroom door into the living room.
This dude, Henry, again, her boyfriend, didn't hear this water running when he was inside the apartment by himself? Like just a couple hours before? Come on.
Evidently not. Or at least he didn't share that detail with police.
So either he's full of shit or someone else entered her apartment after he left, stepped over her lifeless body, turned on the bathroom faucet, and beat feet before Tony Brito and his new partner Henry arrive as a team. I'm going to write that down because that makes absolutely no sense at all, unlike the rest of his actions, which make perfect sense. Of course you didn't look around her apartment when you were alone and bolted like the place was on fire. That's what men do when they think something terrible has happened to the woman they love. And of course you drive all the way to the police station instead of calling them from her phone, which is within arm's reach, or instead of knocking on a neighbor's door and asking to use their phone to call the police. Because when a guy finds his girlfriend's door left wide open and her living room and kitchen is littered with clumps of what appears to be her own hair, the natural reaction is always to not look for her in case she needs help, or to call 911 from the phone you passed on your way out when you bolted like a coward. Any boyfriend worth his salt is going to spend the next 2 hours driving to the police station and thoroughly explaining face to face why these cops need to hurry their asses up and get over to his girlfriend's apartment before it's too late. Man, there's a lot of dust mites in here.
I'm detecting some sarcasm in your voice, Todd.
Was it that obvious?
It was. Grab some Zyrtec, because when Henry sees her with Officer Tony Brito, he says, "Oh my God." And the officer instructs him to go wait outside. Now it's about 1:15, and the officer calls over his radio for rescue personnel and his sergeant and informs his lieutenant that there's a 1056, which is police 10 code for sudden death.
Or an intoxicated person if you work in Indiana. We use 10-0 when someone's dead.
The officer notes in his report that it wasn't readily apparent what the cause of death was, but there were enough suspicious conditions that Sergeant Barlow called for a detective to process the scene.
I like that move. If there's any doubt at all, always call a detective. Worst case scenario, she shows up and she's not needed. And I get extra points for saying she.
Absolutely. So here is a list of what they deemed as suspicious. Door open. Tufts of victim's hair around the apartment. Nude on the bathroom floor. Slices of bread all around her. I can't wait till we get to that part again. Hair wrapped around her left hand and one foot. Refrigerator and kitchen unplugged, but with food inside. Two empty glasses on the table and a small plastic tub of food salad. And, as we've stated, the bathroom faucet running. The detective division responds to the scene and starts canvassing the apartment building.
Never underestimate the importance of a good, thorough neighborhood canvas. And let me tell you, listeners, no one loves a good, thorough neighborhood canvas more than Miss Jessica Knoll. She is the queen of a neighborhood canvas.
I will knock on anyone's door.
She is totally unafraid, more brave than I am. And I'm really stupid. But you have to do that right away and strike while the iron's hot, because you never know what a neighbor might have seen or heard that they wouldn't have thought was important at the time. But after you tell them you just found their neighbor dead on her bathroom floor, now it might be important. What if a neighbor's like, "A blue Camaro pulled out in the middle of the night last night, about 3 a.m. I just figured it was some dumbass kid. But now that I know all this, maybe that was her killer getting away in a hurry." Now, no one said that here. I'm just really good at examples. My point is, you might never find out something like that happened unless you go knocking on doors and you do it while things are fresh.
Because coming back a month later and trying to do it or relying on someone to call them with information on their own, it just doesn't work. And I mean, I can't remember what I had for lunch yesterday, let alone what was happening outside or around me weeks ago that I should have taken notice of.
You had leftover tuna helper, by the way.
No, I didn't, because I'd remember that from the vomiting. But moving on, by about 1:21 p.m., police notify the medical examiner's office. And it's also around that time that patrolman Glenn Hogan, who's also at the scene, makes some notes in his report, something he saw from his position at the front door of the apartment. There was an athletic shoe on a small table to the left of the doorway. On this shoe was a large clump of light brown hair, and it looked as if it had been pulled out of someone's head. There was also a baby sock next to the shoe, and the hair was also on the sock. Note, Lori had very dark hair.
Obviously, that's great potential evidence because it clearly doesn't belong to Lori, so I'm glad they collected it. But also, specifically for the era back then, which is well before DNA, they did have the ability to conclusively match hair to a suspect. But assuming Lauren's expert is right and the medical examiner was wrong, this case is still unsolved right now in 2023. So now it's a fantastic source for DNA, especially if it was pulled from someone's scalp, because that's how police collect it when they do a sexual assault collection kit.
1,000%. But I really want to get into something about the scene that intrigued me. Those slices of bread on the floor around her. There's only one mention of it in the police report, but there's no mention of a bread bag or that any of the bread was collected as evidence. And we'll get to the autopsy a little later, but I'll mention this now. There was no bread found in her stomach.
Spoiler alert.
Sorry, but this makes for a very odd scene visually. And it made me think of this Forensic Files episode that I watched, where the killer dumped a bag of hamburger buns around the victim's body so that he could use the bread bag to carry out the murder weapon, a bloody knife. And as it turns out, he was barefoot when he committed the murder and left footprints in the bread, which ultimately ID'd him. And so it made me wonder if this bread scattered around Lori's body could have left behind any clues. Was the bread bag found? Was it used as a weapon to suffocate her? Were the bread and the bag an afterthought during an unplanned crime inside her apartment? Was the bag used to tote off stolen goods like jewelry? Because it would appear if the bread or the bread bag were at all part of a crime here, there's seemingly no clear plan in place for whatever did occur that day inside her apartment by a potential assailant. According to the reports we have, neither the slices of bread nor a bread wrapper were collected as evidence. In fact, there was no mention of the bread wrapper at the scene at all. This feels like it could have had the potential to be a literal breadcrumb trail to some degree.
I like what you did there with the breadcrumb thing. And also, if people paid attention, you said, "I wonder," right after your first mention of bread. Wonder is great bread. But it's heartbreaking to see that bread wrapper not listed in evidence. Because even if the killer just held or touched the bag barehanded in order to dump the bread out or whatever, and then carelessly leaves the wrapper behind, that obviously could still contain the killer's DNA. But I will say, not to get too far ahead of myself, but if we can trust the original autopsy report, it doesn't appear that she was asphyxiated. But I love what you're doing here. You're looking for simple explanations for bizarre findings. Now you're asking a great question. What if it's not about the bread, but about the bread bag? Love your brain right now.
Thank you. Because there's more bizarre things at that scene we need to explore. Like the hair found throughout her apartment. Clumps of hair. Also found on and entangled within her extremities. It was determined that the dark hair found around the apartment and on her body was likely her own, and it looks as though it had been ripped out of her head.
That's true. The medical examiner did write in his report that the black hair found wrapped around her hand, foot, and scattered throughout her apartment was likely her own hair. And I can't wait to get to the autopsy report so everyone can hear the science behind this brilliant medical opinion.
Sarcasm. But what about the light brown hair on the gym shoe and the baby sock on the table near the front door? Whose hair was that? It was collected as evidence. Was the light brown hair ever tested for DNA? I would be curious to know why a clump of this person's hair was left behind.
We need DNA analysis. Stat!
And finally, I want to talk about those two glasses on the table. These were also collected and have the potential to hold some really important information. Like back then, fingerprints. And fast forward to today, DNA. Unfortunately, we don't know what tests were performed in 1993, but we do know that in 2023, they could certainly test for DNA and at the very least place another person inside her apartment during the time frame when she may have died or sometime beforehand. Again, another witness. Either way, they could hold some vital answers in this case.
Especially with the use of investigative genetic genealogy. Because now you don't need a suspect to compare to or have to wait and rely upon a match in CODIS to find out who it belongs to. But in the absence of DNA, I will say this. This scene is bananas, which means we have to keep in mind, as far as the death scene is concerned, it goes back to the notion that the most simple explanation is usually the right explanation. And knowing that, I think it's entirely possible this scene is misleading. And I'm not saying she wasn't murdered. What I'm saying is it's possible she was murdered, but even if that is the case, all the weird stuff at the scene might have nothing to do with her murder. Or conversely, she wasn't murdered, but all this weird stuff at the scene is causing people to believe she has been murdered. And I say that because other than the forensic pathologist's opinion that offered to review the autopsy report, it's the weird things at the scene that are causing everyone to believe there was foul play. So what happens if we can find reasonable explanations for all those weird things at the scene? And unfortunately, this is all complicated by the fact that the medical examiner got in trouble for wrongdoing, which we'll talk about more in a bit. But if we can reasonably explain a lot of these weird things discovered at the scene, will it still look like a murder? Or will it look more like there's another more viable medical explanation that the shitty medical examiner overlooked?
Or, now just playing devil's advocate here, maybe his initial findings were actually the answer? Yeah, I'm not sure that's the case, but it's interesting to think about.
Sure. And I don't know if any other podcast has explored the scene from this perspective or not, because most podcasters are obviously focused on murders. But we try to stay impartial and look for the truth regardless of where it takes us, because that's what an investigation is, a search for the truth. So don't get mad at us and throw us some shitty comments just because we're exploring other plausible explanations. That's what we're supposed to do.
Well, you can message Todd. I mean, his email is todd@burningmat. Just don't send me any. Since we are here searching for the truth, let's skip the autopsy report for now and dive into what we've learned about Lori and what was happening in her life at that time. And some of those in her life we've already mentioned in the timeline leading up to her death, like her sister Allison, her friend Rebecca, and her boyfriend Henry. And within that last week, we've already learned some things about Lori. But one other thing that her sister told police was that Lori was being treated by East Bay Mental Health for depression and schizophrenia.
Which is definitely something to write in your notebook, because we know two things. Number one, she was wanting her sister to take her to the doctor after she cashed her check, which she never got to do. So it's very plausible she was out of meds. And number two, according to those close to her, it's also very possible she was self-medicating the week or two prior to her getting sick and when she stopped communicating with them. Her friend Rebecca said Lori was all messed up when she spoke to her, and Lori said she took some pills that made her feel really good. And then her boyfriend Henry claimed her cocaine use had increased during that time, but he also claims the last time he saw her was on Monday, March 1st. Now, cocaine usually won't show up in your blood after 2 days. Some prescription medications, especially some antipsychotics, can take up to twice that long to get out of your blood. So maybe her tox screen will help paint a more clear picture of what exactly was going on.
Hold on, Todd. We'll get to the tox screen in a minute with the autopsy too. But let me just go back a little bit and let you know that her friend Rebecca actually elaborated on Lori's addiction and mental illness. They go back for 7 years. All started when she stayed with her and her mom after a treatment in a mental health clinic in the mid-80s. During her stay with them, she said Lori appeared sober, but Lori had others in her life who didn't make it in any of the police reports that we have. There were no witness statements from people like a man who Henry mentioned regularly visiting Lori at her apartment, the mysterious man we refer to as D, and who Henry claimed he saw coming to Lori's home and allegedly selling her cocaine. Based on those reports, it's hard to decipher whether or not he was overlooked as a suspect or even questioned. That said, Todd, walk us through something here. The major difference for an investigator between a suspect and a person of interest. And are there either in this case?
Okay, so a person of interest is basically someone that's not passing the smell test. They stink, right? They stick out from everyone else in the victim's life because of nefarious activity, maybe some suspicious behavior at the time, past criminal history, something weird or off-putting they said to a witness, things like that. They are potential suspects. A suspect is someone that we can articulate had a clear motive for committing the crime and without question had the opportunity to commit the crime. So a person of interest becomes a suspect when we've established those two things and we are completely confident we can defend both those things under scrutiny of first a prosecutor and eventually a defense attorney who's really good at their job. Until you reach that point, you treat a person of interest much differently than you do a suspect. And to answer your original question, I didn't see anyone in these reports that I would feel comfortable calling a suspect. Not yet.
Okay. So riddle me this. What are the major differences between how you handle a person of interest versus a suspect? Because at 2 o'clock that day, the day they found her, her boyfriend Henry was read his rights and signed a statement stating that he had been informed that he was a suspect in the crime. And it seemed kind of premature since we don't know if there was a crime here yet, right?
Right. I'll sum up how I handle them differently by specifically explaining why I don't think these detectives should have classified the boyfriend, Henry Costa, as a suspect yet. And I don't know because it's not in these reports that we have what his alibi was and or whether or not it held up under scrutiny. So I'm going to stick to motive. The closest they have for motive is that he said he and Lori were in a fight the week before she died because he wanted her to stop doing cocaine and she did not want to stop doing cocaine. Now, I don't want to take that to my prosecutor and ask her to hang our hat on that as motive during a trial, because she's going to laugh me right out of her office and tell me to go back to writing traffic tickets. Because how many of us have someone we care about that we want to stop abusing drugs, but they won't? Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the defense rests. That's how that would go.
No, I get that. That's a good defense there. But I have to say, I've been getting the feeling, and not so subtly, that you might have the same suspicions of Henry as these detectives did then. So are you calling him a person of interest? Putting yourself in their shoes at that time, of course.
Yes. That's what Quantum Leap Todd is labeling him as. Because right now I'm stuck in that detective's body in 1993, and I can't get back to the present until I figure out how to fix this guy's life. So I can only speak from his perspective. Her boyfriend is a person of interest and needs to be treated differently than a suspect because doing so greatly increases your odds of getting him to provide you with what you need. And that's information, be it truthful or bullshit. We don't care either way, because with persons of interest, it's all about locking them into as many details in their story as possible, which requires their unguarded cooperation, or at least as unguarded as you can get them.
Okay. Cheesiest time travel show reference aside, maybe you're not off your rocker after all.
Thank you.
So let me see if I know where you're going with this. If you run too hard at someone you believe is a potential suspect and put them in a custodial situation, like hauling them to the station, putting them in an interview or interrogation room and make them feel as if they're not free to leave until you say so, then you have to break out a rights waiver and all the scary legal stuff, which will likely cause them to lawyer up instead of talking freely. And if that happens and you haven't been able to clearly establish your motive and opportunity yet, you really hindered the investigation.
Yep, exactly. Because you don't have to read them their Miranda rights until you put them in a position where a reasonable person would believe they are in custody, meaning they are not free to leave whenever they want. And element two that must exist at the same time that exists is that you're going to ask them questions that could elicit an incriminating response. So save that for people that truly aren't free to leave at any time they choose. The ones you know that you can arrest at any time, whether they cooperate or not. Save that shit for your suspects. You can ask a person of interest all the incriminating questions you want without reading the Miranda, as long as you can articulate they were in an environment where any reasonable person would assume they are free to leave at any time. You don't need to read the Miranda. Talk with your persons of interest. Interview them without them realizing you're interviewing them, and do not interrogate them. There's no need to put them on the defensive yet. Keep them loose and feeling like a witness as long as you can. And don't talk to them at the station, like you said. Do it in a parking lot or at their home, and do it alone. Don't surround them with a bunch of cops, because that changes things. That makes it custodial. You need them talking freely so they lock themselves into their story with as many details as possible. That's your job, because the more details they commit to, the easier it is to prove whether or not their story is truthful.
Got it. So you feel like they might have jumped the gun on Henry a smidge here.
Hell yeah, I do. I don't know whether or not he hurt Lori, obviously, but his story stinks worse than baby farts. But even so, we have a long way to go before we can call this guy a suspect. Mostly because, let's not forget, as this case stands right now, there's no crime. Murder, or anything else close to murder, has not been medically established yet. But if we catch the guy who brought the police to our door in a big-ass lie, or a bunch of big-ass lies, that could change some shit. It's a game of finesse, Jessica. Just like when you're chasing a big story and you need someone on the inside of that chemical company to trust you enough to start talking about how their bosses knew all along that they were dumping toxic chemicals into the water supply of that small town, causing everyone to get sick and die. That was more directed at Aaron Brockovich, but the comparison to you, big compliment.
Dang. Aaron Brockovich, you're full of it today. But I'll take the compliment. Let's quickly look at some other people right now. Lauren's biological father, Thomas Kelly. Now, according to Lauren, Lori broke up with him in July of 1992. And after they broke up, she writes in her planner, "Tommy's threats over Lauren will soon settle." That was concerning to some, but we don't know what those threats were about. So, person of interest?
Bingo. We talked to him, lock him into an alibi, and start talking to all the people that were close to Lori in order to find out what those threats were about. Then we go on from there.
Sure. We're after motive and opportunity. And if he has both, we've got him. But if he doesn't, we move on, like I'm doing right now. I'm moving on to Lori's ex-husband, Scary Harry, who I'm guessing is no stranger to being a person of interest with a nickname like that.
I'm Scary Harry.
They had some domestic issues in the past. Specifically, he was convicted of felony assault against her in 1990. That landed him behind bars, which was also where he was brushing his teeth the morning Lori died.
I was in prison when she died, and I'm still in prison right now, which is where we're sitting while you interview me. Pretty solid alibi.
Scratch him from the list, because we've still got a lot of work to do. D, the door-to-door cocaine salesman, person of interest? Albeit, we really don't know that much about him.
Hell yes, person of interest. There's not one mention in any of these police reports about anyone talking or trying to talk to D. And there's a lot of other people mentioned in these reports that they did talk to, which leads me to believe D was not talked to. But other than the accusation that he was a drug dealer, and that was Lori's boyfriend, Henry, who said that, by the way, so take that for what it's worth. But other than that, there's literally nothing to indicate he was a problem for Lori. But he's still a nefarious character who's allegedly in her life and saw her at least 7 days prior to her death. So we need to identify him and see what he has to say, because that's Detective 101. And knowing that, When I looked through these reports and I found no mention of anyone ever identifying him and or talking to him, it's super freaking disappointing, because then I want to know, what other basic investigative things didn't they do? You have to talk to the Coke dealer. Have they not watched True Romance? The Coke dealer in that movie's name was Drexel, which starts with D. I'm just saying.
Also, Dennis Hopper stole that movie.
Thank you. He had three scenes and stole the whole movie. R.I.P.
All right. A lot of people who knew Lori well were interviewed, though. And as we've already said, according to all those statements, it appears that Lori lived what police might refer to as an at-risk lifestyle, at least more than most. I don't think it's necessary for us to go in every aspect of that, because despite any of it, other than her being sick all that week and asking her sister to keep Lauren, there's really no specific event or sudden changes in her life, none that were documented in these reports anyway. Because any significant changes in her life helps point detectives in the direction of a specific person that might have had the motive or opportunity for killing her.
10,000%. We're just kind of left with this overall sense that Lori was battling mental health issues, and as a result of that, she might have been self-medicating. And if that's true, that might make her more vulnerable, I guess, to health issues. And according to some decisions, those close to her claim she was making around this time, could make her more apt than most to come into contact with someone new who might be dangerous. And that's something to keep in mind. Not that we believe that's what's happened here. It's just something that you have to keep in mind. Because when you learn all these things about Lori, you begin to understand how difficult things became for the investigators, especially if the original autopsy was botched. Because when there's no obvious suspects, you need that autopsy. You need it to provide you with something to go on. And unfortunately, the original autopsy that has now been deemed unreliable listed her manner of death as natural. So where were these detectives supposed to go from there? And listen, I've been pretty hard on these guys for the most basic things I don't believe they did. But maybe they just simply didn't do them because, thanks to the medical examiner, there was no crime to investigate.
And that's why we need to take a hard look at what the ME did find to come to that conclusion. And all the ins and outs of what we've been ducking in and out of the entire war room, the autopsy. All right, I'm going to give you a quick rundown. Recent bruising on her right upper arm and upper thighs. Strands of her own hair in the palm of her hand. And a bracelet of hair around the palm and fingers of her left hand, again, consistent with her own. Clump of hair between her toes on left foot. Her heart indicates no evidence of right ventricular hypertrophy. However, there is a moderate degree of concentric left ventricular hypertrophy present. Her stomach contains only a small amount of brown fluid, and there's no food in her stomach.
And ultimately, he determines Lori's cause of death, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is the thickening and stiffening of the heart's wall until it can no longer do its job. So her heart stopped, manner of death, natural.
The medical examiner notes in his summary, quote, "This is a 30-year-old white female with a history of cocaine abuse and a history of schizophrenia treated with lithium malarol. She was found unclothed, lying on the floor of the bathroom of her residence, and had had a several-day history of flu-like symptoms and was not feeling well," end quote. But according to her toxicology report, which I promised we'd get to, Todd, there was no cocaine or any other drug found in her system. The coroner's report does readily mention items found at the scene, making note of the open door, tufts of hair, body found nude, running water, unplugged fridge, empty glasses, food out, and again, those slices of bread around her body.
Cool that he reiterated some shit the detectives told him, but here's some medical shit from his report. And I'll preface it with a disclaimer. We don't know how much we can trust this medical examiner, but here we go. A sexual assault kit was completed. No seminal fluid found on her vaginal or rectal walls, alluding to no recent sexual intercourse, consensual or otherwise. No petechial hemorrhages anywhere. They checked a lot of places. No bruises, lacerations, or pressure marks are seen involving the neck. So basically, this medical examiner has all but ruled out asphyxiation or strangulation as a possible cause of death. But he does remark that she has bruises on her upper arm and upper thighs. So take that for what it's worth. And here's where things get fun. He documents that the hair in the palm of her right hand and wrapped around her left hand and the clump of hair between her toes are all consistent with the hair of the decedent, which is Lori. Cool, but what I don't see in his report or in any of the investigative reports is evidence that large clumps of hair are missing from her scalp. Nor do I see any mention of anyone forensically proving whether or not that's Lori's hair. I want something more scientifically conclusive than it doesn't look like it's not her hair, which is essentially what this person whose name starts with doctor wrote in his damn report. And I can only assume that everyone else was cool with that. The reason I require something more scientific than that is Lori's boyfriend described her alleged cocaine dealer, D, and this is all in the police reports, as having long black hair with a ponytail in the back. So is it Lori's hair or not? This isn't the 1600s. Let's go.
Well, here's what you need to know about the original medical examiner who examined Lori. He lost his license to practice both in Rhode Island and in Massachusetts.
Listen, losing your license to practice in two different states, just in one state, takes a lot. That's not something the licensing board takes lightly. So trust me when I tell you, he must have fucked up big time, which would support the opinion of the forensic pathologist that consulted with Lauren, which was this medical examiner incorrectly closed the case with a natural manner of death caused by hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Because this expert noted that the medical examiner's medical opinion conflicted with his own damn notes. Specifically, he described a lack of significant damage to Lori's heart. And this expert also noted that Dr. Shitty ME did not make note of the condition of Lori's scalp or comment on the fact that she had a clean toxicology screening, which is everything I had a problem with, which basically makes me a forensic pathologist.
And those are things that I was concerned about too. So it's nice to get confirmation from an actual forensic pathologist.
You're welcome. I'll tell you what else I'll be interested to find out after the reexamination of Lori's body, whether or not they tested for the presence of arsenic or some other poisons in the initial autopsy. I'm positive they're going to test for it this time because Lauren is specifically concerned about that. But did they do that then? It's not in the report, so I'd assume not. Even though hair loss is a symptom of poisoning, specifically arsenic poisoning. And you usually have to intentionally look for that and test for that in order to know if it's present in the body or not. So I'm eager to hear those results because as you and I know, Jessica, they can detect lethal amounts of arsenic for a very long time after death. And we know that because we found where they exhumed President Zachary Taylor's body 141 years after his death and were able to conclusively prove he did not die from arsenic poisoning. So obviously logic would dictate if they could conclusively prove he was not poisoned by arsenic, they felt scientifically confident they could also prove he was poisoned by arsenic if that was indeed the case, even 141 years later. So boom, science. Not a single listener, by the way, of this show knew that about Zachary Taylor until right now. That's a free piece of trivia from us to you, so go dazzle your friends with it this weekend during your kid's boring-ass soccer game. You're welcome.
I can think of other games I'd rather be watching. Oh, okay. Let's back up for a minute and talk about the brown liquid found in her stomach and connect those dots back to the scene. Because like we said, there were two glasses inside her apartment that police collected as evidence, and the brown fluid in her stomach could indicate that she shared a drink with the last person to see her alive that day. Therefore, those glasses could hold some clues in this case. So I reached out to one of our expert friends, Dr. Kimberly Masnick, because I wanted to understand better what the liquid still in her stomach could mean for the timeline and for the potential time of death. Here's what she told me. Liquids are digested much quicker than food, and the digestion stops immediately once a person is deceased. Women typically digest slower than men, and liquids faster than solids. Meals are fully digested between 4 to 6 hours, Liquid, however, is digested much faster because there's nothing to break down. And the more liquid in the stomach, the closer to the time of death. And we know she had a small amount of liquid in her stomach. So her time of death would be between 2 to 4 hours following the time that she drank it. Lori was found during the wellness check at 1 o'clock, putting a potential time of death sometime that morning.
This is what bothers me the most after learning this piece of information. The police couldn't find anyone that could commit to seeing or hearing from her after March 2nd. That's 5 days before she died. 5 days. What happened during those 5 days? That's a huge window of time. Surely someone else saw or spoke to her during that time. Did police bother to check her phone records? Did she stay isolated in her apartment for 5 days and not see or speak to one single person or even a married one?
Right, because people claim they knocked on her door between March 2nd and the 7th, but that she didn't come to the door. And they said they called, but she didn't answer.
And again, according to her boyfriend, who has the worst cover stories ever, her door was left open when he arrived that morning on March 7th. So if no one else had a key...
And if she wasn't in her apartment during those attempts, that means someone must have seen her out and about somewhere, sometime within those 5 days. Surely she spoke with someone or made a purchase somewhere. And if so, that would mean someone who knows something has not come forward. And that makes the journalistic instincts in me scream because I want to find that person. I want to go knock on their door and talk to them. They may have that one missing puzzle piece from her timeline, or at the very least, retrace her steps for those 5 days to see where her footprints lead us and who they lead us to. On the other hand, maybe she was home alone for 5 days and either didn't want to or couldn't answer the phone or the door.
And that makes the detective instincts in me caterwaul, which is a way fancier word for scream. I just looked it up. Because if she never left her home that entire 5 day period and never answered her phone or came to the door, why? Is that explainable behavior of someone experiencing a mental health crisis? Maybe. I really hope the police exhausted all available means to explore those 5 missing days in her timeline because that's where the answers are. But unfortunately, when you read that last paragraph of the police report, it doesn't look like they did. But in their defense, when you read that autopsy report, you have to ask yourself, why would they? Basically, they were told she had a heart attack by the doctor assigned to determine how people die there. And unfortunately, that seems to be a very plausible explanation for everything that would otherwise cause us to believe these investigators were negligent or not good at their job.
We did try to talk to the detective currently assigned to her case, but he couldn't comment on an ongoing investigation, which I totally understand. And we certainly wouldn't want to jeopardize anything to do with her case. But I got to tell you, Todd, I'm thrilled to hear that Lori's death investigation is ongoing. So with that good news, let's make that final turn and head down the straightaway. So here's what they uncovered from the scene, and we've gone over a lot of the evidence already collected and the oddities that were there, like the bread and the hair and the unplugged refrigerator. And they were all things that have stood out and kind of perplexed everyone that's looked over Lori's case for decades. I mean, they certainly have piqued my curiosity.
And they should pique your curiosity. They're freaking weird. But sometimes when working crime scenes, we have a tendency to overthink things we see or find that don't have an obvious explanation, or that we have difficulty making sense of. And there's obviously no shortage of those within the scene at Lori's apartment. First, let's talk about the refrigerator stocked with food that was found unplugged from the wall. It's perfectly natural to assume there's no way Lori unplugged that refrigerator because she would know in doing so, all her food would go bad. So if you assume that, then you assume someone else unplugged it. So what reason would another person, maybe even her killer, have for doing this? Is he also a killer of groceries? Or was there an even more devious reason? And then you start down this rabbit hole, searching for possible explanations, none of which are likely to make sense. So stop creating things that don't exist yet and start investigating things that are right in front of your face, starting with the victim.
Well, I'm glad you said that, Todd, because we've learned through statements taken from people that knew Lori that she suffered from schizophrenia. And according to her autopsy, there was no presence of lithium or the other drug in her blood or urine, suggesting she had not been taking either of her medications for a while. So we did a little research into the condition and found something that occurs with those who have schizophrenia called sensory flooding. Basically, people suffering from schizophrenia often report being hypersensitive to sounds, sometimes to the point where even the sound of a running refrigerator is unbearable, so they unplug it. Now, this doesn't mean conclusively that Lori was experiencing this during the time leading up to her death and that as a result, she unplugged the refrigerator. It just means that given what we know about her, it does offer a reasonable and logical explanation to an otherwise unreasonable and illogical discovery at the crime scene.
One of our partners at Burning Mountain Productions is Cy Ray, hands down the greatest detective I have ever met. And Cy found something for us. When a person consumes cocaine and lithium over a prolonged period of time, they can be at an even greater risk of ventricular hypertrophy than if only consuming cocaine over a long period of time. Now, developing this condition doesn't necessarily mean that it will kill that person, but just know that people with dilated cardiomyopathy sometimes experience severe flu-like symptoms leading up to their death. And I know I'm getting in the weeds here with all these medical terms, but just know that dilated cardiomyopathy is in the same family as hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And you can read up on the difference for yourself. But right now, all you need to know is that you can end up with that particular condition by traveling the exact same road that leads to the others. And I think that's worth noting, especially since the medical examiner's thoroughness is in question and she was experiencing flu-like symptoms the week leading up to her death. And since the medical examiner's thoroughness is in question, let's take these hypotheses a bit further. Because Cy's discovery led us to find this. Even in short-term use, the combination of lithium and cocaine can be deadly. Because lithium changes cocaine while it's in the liver to something different and way worse. Even more so than high volumes of alcohol. And much like cases of too much alcohol in combination with cocaine, lithium and cocaine can create cocaethylene. And cocaethylene can get trapped in the liver and eventually enter the bloodstream. And that can cause sudden cardiac arrest. But wait, there's more. Because before that sudden cardiac arrest, it can cause symptoms like accelerated heart rate and very high body temperature. Now remember, she was found naked and her front door was open. So was she trying to cool off? It's got me thinking. Because it can also cause severe dehydration and extreme thirst. And we know her bathroom faucet was left running. And in at least one case of extremely high body temperature and dehydration, and I'm assuming there are plenty of other instances because I found this one very quickly, a child locked in a hot car pulled fistful of her own hair out by the roots before finally dying from heat exhaustion. Now, one article does not constitute a case study, so let's not apply for any grants yet. Plus, we don't even know if they originally tested for cocaethylene in Lori's blood. We only know that it stays in the blood far longer than cocaine, and it's far more toxic to the heart and other organs than cocaine. So let's just file everything I just said under frickin' maybe. And maybe because of what Jessica explained about the refrigerator being unplugged, we stay open-minded and accept that it's at least conceivable Lori was also experiencing a mental health crisis during the week leading up to her death, and that some or all of the bizarre findings at the scene were a result of that crisis being compounded with the bizarre but natural medical condition that tragically took Lori's life. Now, we're not offering conclusive medical evidence or opinion here, because regardless of what Jessica thinks, I am not a forensic pathologist. So we're just asking that you stay open-minded and consider that a plausible explanation. and Turnabout's fair play, so also plausible, she fell victim to foul play. We don't know because according to at least one forensic pathologist who did not get stripped of their medical license, the medical examiner probably botched the autopsy, which brought a screeching halt to the investigation. Now that's a lot of doom and gloom, but all is not lost because at least for Lauren's sake, her mom's body has been exhumed. So hopefully the reexamination of her remains finally provides some real answers.
And with those answers, potentially in a real life quantum leap instance, going back in time and reversing that pivotal moment in 1993 when the detectives typed those dreaded two words on the final page of their report. Case closed.
And that's everything we had access to, which was a lot, thanks in large part to Lauren Malloy and the exhaustive research she has done on her mother's case. And thank goodness for the expert's review of the shitty medical examiner's work, because I'm sure that had a lot to do with getting the court order to exhume Lori's body. And now Lauren is finally a major step closer to finding out what really happened to her mom.
Lauren's fight for the truth all started when her mom's friend told her that the police and the medical examiner had it all wrong, that she was in fact murdered. And if this friend is right, it happened 30 years ago. And it's tough to get the wheels of justice in motion when they've been idle for so long. But because of Lauren's tenacity, she not only got confirmation that her mother's death was not properly investigated, but she got legal authority to get her mom's remains in competent hands so her death can be properly investigated. This daughter is leading the charge for uncovering what happened to her mom 3 decades ago. She won't stop or back down until she gets answers. And that's where she is today.
In September of 2021, the original prosecutor assigned to the case was like, yeah, no, like it's not going to be reopened. We're not going to exhume her. We're not going to retest things, which totally floored me. One of the things he said was, you know, I guess we're just going to be stuck with an unknown. And I think that was one of the biggest motivators to me because I was like, absolutely not. That's not happening. So I got off the phone with him and got on the phone with the ME's office and was like, we need to talk. So went back to them in October of 2021, met again with the chief medical examiner, and he reconfirmed for me that she did not die of natural causes. He said, quote, we need to open the grave and exhume the body to figure out how she died. And so I was like, okay, like, I know I'm not crazy. You're telling me this. I don't know why the state's saying no. So I kept trying to get a response from them. Didn't work. So I started going to representatives, senators, the governor's office. And that was around May of 2022. At the same time, I also got an independent forensic pathologist out of state to review the original autopsy reports and everything. He sent over his findings. That was basically like, the original cause and manner of death were not supported by the autopsy reports. This whole thing needs to be reinvestigated by police. The original cause of death is unlikely to be correct. So it was like, well, now you've got the chief ME, this other expert pathologist, all these people who are saying the same thing. I had thousands of people that signed a petition I created online. So armed with all of that, the media just kind of kept going. And then in June of 2022, I got a call from the AG's office. The chief of the criminal division was like, yeah, you know what? Different prosecutors can come to different conclusions. Send me what you've got and I'm going to re-examine the case. So I sent a boatload of information to him and met with him and his team in August of 2022. And he said, yeah, we're going to work with the chief ME and we're going to petition the court, motion to get your mom exhumed. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, I can't believe that this is happening. And I really hope that the court doesn't deny this because where do you go from there? It was going to be another roadblock. So then early November 2022, I learned that the court granted the motion to exhume her. The motion itself is sealed, so I don't know exactly what was included. That was also a good sign to me that, you know, they wanted to protect the integrity of an investigation. And then February 1st of this year, my mom was finally exhumed, and that was really exciting. And now we're just waiting on those results.
Unsolved RI is offering a $1,000 reward for information leading to an arrest. So here's how you can help. You can share this case and her story on social media, and you can sign Lauren's online petition on change.org. A special thanks to Lauren Malloy for bringing us her mom's case and story, and for allowing us to get to know her. But as we know, for so many cases, it takes a village to solve these.
And Lauren has a very strong village and a fantastic support team around her to help with her mom's case and for other unsolved cases. We're talking about Unsolved Rhode Island or Unsolved RI. So please check out their Facebook group and also our friends at Uncovered. Check them out at uncovered.com. Lauren calls this talented and devoted group of justice warriors Team Sled Dog in honor of her mom. And I'm sure that makes her mom smile.
Like a message meant for her in the future, Lauren's mom left behind notes and little reminders like, take care, walk in the light always, love Lori Lee, be on the lookout for the beautiful, and do your best, encourage your heart to sing. And 3 decades later, Lauren Lee has her own message for her mom, her namesake, and the eternal free spirit, Lori Lee Sled Dog Malloy.
I'm keeping my promise, and I've got this for you. I'm not going to let you down, and I'm also not going to stop living my life. I'm still going to do all the other things I'm supposed to do, but this is the one thing I'm going to do for you.
We'll keep you updated on Lori Lee Malloy's case, but in the meantime, if you have a case you'd like us to dig into, email us the details to theinvestigatorspodcast@gmail.com.
And follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Investigators Podcast. And on TikTok. Jessica's going to be posting on that account because TikTok hates me. You can find links for all of those accounts on our website, as well as today's show notes. And the show notes, by the way, that's where you can find contact information for the East Providence Police Department in case you have information to share on Lori's case, along with links to virtually every other case resource we've mentioned. Oh, and we have a section on the site for case updates for when those start to come in. Everything is there. I should have just said that, so I will. Everything is there. It's a good read. So next time you take a poop, visit investigatorspodcast.com.
If you like this show, please tell your friends and take a moment to rate and write a review. We appreciate your feedback and your generous number of stars.
You guys are the reason this show is back, and I think better than ever, because there's two of us now. And if Jessica is two and I'm one, then two is better than one. That's some seriously self-deprecating math I just did.
Aw, that's even better than flowers or a bowl of soup when I'm sick.
I know what I'm doing. I've been married 3 times.
Third time's a charm. At least that's my advice. But for our listeners, please take a moment today and hug the ones you love. Be kind and take care of each other.
And most importantly, please don't murder anyone. Because if you do, you might have to deal with us. Because we're the investigators!
I came from the mud. There's dirt on my hands. Strong like a tree. There's roots where I stand. Oh, I've been running from the law. Hope they won't shoot me down soon. Catch me howling at the moon.
Mental illness affects millions of people worldwide. If you or someone you know is suffering from a mental illness, you're not alone. And there is help and resources available. Visit NAMI.org. That's NAMI.org to find resources in your area.